Thanks everybody for coming. I'm Cody Ray Anderson. I work in the Web Communications Unit in the Office of Communications and External Relations. And today I'll be talking about designing an effective information architecture for your website. I'm going to stop periodically for questions, but if at any point you've got, I'm unclear about anything, just put up your hand. The only thing I'd ask is if you could turn on your microphones. This session's being recorded. Turn on your microphones when you're asking a question, if that wasn't clear. The session's being recorded, so if you turn it on, that means we can hear you in the recording, and the answer will probably make more sense. All right, so let's begin. The structure of this presentation will be sort of roughly half theory and half practice, I guess. The first half will cover sort of the principles that we're working with when we're designing sort of how a website is structured. And the second half will be putting that into practice and some things you should keep in mind when you're doing that. So the first thing to get out of the way, what are we talking about? Information architecture might not be a phrase that all of you are familiar with. Website architecture, similarly. The two are sort of subtly different. When I'm talking about a website architecture, I'm specifically talking about how your site is structured. You'll probably recognize this screen from the WMS system, which is a visualization of what your website navigation architecture looks like. Information architecture, which is the sort of the industry term, is a little bit more abstract. It's how, what information is on your site, how you present it to people, and how it's sort of hierarchically structured. That said, I'll use the terms more or less interchangeably, since we are, I assume, all working in the WMS Drupal system. I think a lot of the stuff that I'm covering in the first part, even if you're not working in the Drupal system, might be useful to you. So maybe I'll get a show of hands. Who here has seen this screen? Just about everybody. Okay, that's good. This is a visualization, as I said, of a website architecture. In this case, I believe the About McGill site, where you have the top-level menu items either appearing in the sort of vertical navigation at the top of the screen, or if you don't have that, the vertical navigation at the left-hand side of the screen. I meant horizontal when I said vertical the first time. And then under each item, the links that will appear when you click on the top-level item. As I said, the first part of the presentation will be fairly theoretical, but if anything's a bit unclear to you, just let me know, and I can probably provide a concrete example of what I'm talking about. I'll try not to get too far up into the clouds. So when should we actually start thinking about the website architecture? You really want to think about it when you're in the planning stages, either in the planning stages of building a new website or if you are planning to do a major overhaul on your site. You generally don't want to make sort of incremental changes, unless you have very, very good reasons to do so. The problem that causes is basically twofold. You've got broken links, so places where you or someone else has linked to your page on, you know, bursaries for international students, and suddenly that section moves, and nobody can find it anymore. The other problem is when stuff moves around in the navigation, even people who are familiar with your site and aren't going to that page directly, they'll get confused. They'll be, why is this not where I expect it to be? So for both of these reasons, it's really preferable to plan these things ahead of time. And I'll cover some other things we can do to manage these changes and minimize the disruptions caused by them a bit later in the session, in sort of the practical session section. Any questions right off the bat? Excellent. So the first principle you should think about when you are planning for an overhaul of your website or creating a new website is to know your audiences. I put the S in parentheses because some people are only really appealing to one audience, be they students or staff. But frequently there are sites that need to appeal to different audiences, and even sites that are only directed at students. Maybe some of them are going to be new students, some of them are going to be students that have been here for 4 years and know where everything is. So even splitting it down that finely can be helpful. Pretty much covered this. You should always have a strong idea of who is using your site. This seems pretty obvious, but especially when you've been working on a site for a long time and you kind of get into the headspace of it, you can kind of get disconnected from who's actually using your site and what their priorities, what their goals and objectives are. Another advantage to this is, especially when you're dealing with one of these large sites that have multiple audiences, thinking about this can provide the basis for your architecture's top level. I'm going to give an example here. A typical faculty site might have the sections roughly about us, prospective students, current students, research, news and events, contact us. That's pretty standard. And this is, along with the obvious prospective students and current students, sort of split up by audience, where about us, news and events, contact us, those are sort of directed at everybody, but specifically they're geared towards people who don't know much about the unit, don't know much about the faculty, and want to learn more, want to get in touch with them. Prospective students and current students, as the names suggest, will be directed at those groups. Research might be directed at researchers and, if appropriate, industry representatives. Another advantage of this kind of an architecture, along with kind of providing an easy-to-use first step in terms of splitting up the top level, is that you can kind of tweak your messaging. This is going a little bit more nitty-gritty in terms of communications, but to tweak your messaging based on who you expect to be browsing that section. The main example of this is that a lot of times we get the complaint that current students, current staff, current faculty don't like the feeling that they're being like marketed to. So if that's kind of left in the sections where that's appropriate for students who are just looking at prospective students who are just looking at enrolling, as well as external audiences, you can kind of tone down that risk of alienating current students, staff, and faculty. So much as it's kind of easy to throw ideas around and try to get in the headspace of these people using your site, it's really, really helpful to get actual input or feedback from real people. This is a good sort of second step after the theorizing to work out the kind of details of the architecture. So when you're building or revamping your site, it's a good thing to consider running a survey or sort of speaking to focus groups of students, faculty, or staff who use your site. Presumably this is going to be primarily internal audiences because those are the people we often have the best access to. Actually, if you're interested in doing this, our web communications unit can help you out with this. We have some experience running these kinds of surveys. And we also have experience in helping interpret the results and use them to leverage them to improve sort of what we're looking at for the architecture. Beyond just your usual question sort of survey, we also have a usability testing tool, which I'll go into a little bit. It's called Loop 11, and we can use this to actually gather quantitative data about how users navigate your site when they're given certain goals. Here's a nice little graphic. So loop 11 tests basically are a series of tasks and questions that are presented to the user who opts into taking the test. The tool collects data on, first of all, whether users can complete the task that you assign them, whether they're able to find, for instance, a page about, again, bursaries for international students, how long it actually took them to do that, and what path they took to get there, what links they clicked on, where they went in the architecture. This data can be really helpful in identifying areas where improvements in the architecture are needed and to back up the need to change certain areas of the architecture in places where, for example, we need to go through approval processes. If you're interested, I'm going to provide some contact information closer to the end of the lecture. And if you want to write down that, you can get in touch with us and we can see if we can help you out. So one caveat about using user feedback is that while their input can be, as I say, invaluable, you really do have to keep in mind best practices at the same time. Frequently, users have a really good idea of what they want, but maybe they've also got some ideas about how they want to get it that are not right, frankly. A really prominent example of this is the idea of having a flat navigation structure where everything is presented to the user on one page. The advantage of this is that it means that everybody's one click away from pretty much whatever they're getting to. The problem with it is I got an excerpt from this great article, which I'll have a link to later in the session, which I'll just read out because I really think it paints a clearer picture than anything ineloquent me could say. A greater number of options can make it more difficult for people to make a decision. More options means more cognitive effort, and more effort can sometimes mean more anxiety. And this is the thrust. People think they like having a lot of options, but they really do not. In the article, he's pretty much summarizing a book called The Paradox of Choice, which this is pretty much the thesis statement for it. So when we're designing an architecture, this is one example where, again, people think that they want one thing, but what they actually want is something else. So the right way to use feedback, then, is to find out what specific pieces of information, what specific tools, what content users need, and then make sure that that's easy to find and straightforward to find. When I say easy, I mean that the sort of important stuff is prominent, both in the architecture and on individual pages, but also straightforward. Honestly, you're not going to be able to make every piece of important content the most prominent thing on the site. Otherwise, you just end up, again, with that kind of flat navigation. So what you want to aim for is making it straightforward to find so that it's easy for users to see a path to what content they need. They know what their next step is going to be. As long as users don't get confused, they don't really care that much about clicking more. Any questions? Excellent. Okay. I'm a little bit confused about my slide order here. Okay. When we're in the process... Oh.
Good?
Yep.
Okay. I think you mentioned it, but if you use loop and you see that there's a problem... with the architecture of the site, but it's not something that we can fix on our end. Like, it really, it's a problem with the Drupal that McGill has. Mm-hmm.
Well, in those cases, there are often ways we can work around it, and as I'll mention later, we work closely with IT on projects. So depending on, again, the sort of concrete instance of what's happening, there are a number of possible solutions. Again, I'd urge you to get in touch with us at... the address, which I'll bring up later, to sort of suss this out. Kind of hard to talk about this in an abstract way without knowing the individual problem.
Yeah, no, I just know that I think McGill's getting a new version, Drupal 7, come August.
That's not going to change from what I understand. Not from IT, from communications. It's not going to change much of the sort of outward-facing part of it, part of the Drupal system. Okay. Any other questions? Excellent. So when we're working with an architecture, when we're planning this architecture, it's extremely helpful to be able to visualize it. I don't know if anybody here has worked with us on any project, but when we're overhauling or building a site, we use an Excel template that looks a little bit like this. It's sort of couldn't be more simple. First level, second level, third level, fourth level, fifth level of the architecture. Big title at the top. That's it. But it has the advantage of providing us sort of a bird's eye view of the content that we're looking at. Further, it shows relationships between pieces of content at a high level, where we can kind of make sense of a hierarchical organization and categorization of the content. Obviously, you can use whatever techniques are useful to you. Flowcharts, sitemaps are similar to sort of what we were using with the Excel document there. Flowcharts where the hierarchical structure is expressed can also be helpful. I keep using the word hierarchical. So when we're organizing our content, we want to use it. We want to use sort of common sense categories. A method that's often used for this when people have the ability to, the resources to, is card sorting, where sort of topics or like single words are written on cards, and then you're kind of given a set of categories, and people put the cards in each of the categories. The idea is that, you know, you test 10 people with this, and then you'll have sort of an idea where, you know, the bursaries page should go, where the, et cetera page should go. Again, this is something for when those resources are available. Frequently, they aren't, and frequently it's more of a matter of sort of just writing it down on paper and saying, you know, this is what we're looking at. Any questions there? All right. So going back to the theme of sort of managing the choices that are presented to users, as that quote that I read out before illustrates, what we really want to strive for is presenting the user with a few choices where their sort of next step is obvious, where they're always getting closer to their goal. This is more effective than presenting them with a huge list that they have to take in. For the top level of navigation, and in fact, for pretty much every level of navigation, what you're usually trying for is to get about 6 to 8 items. Especially with sort of lower levels of the navigation, it's going to be hard to get there. But the reason being that 7 is actually, I put a magic number there. I'm remembering back to first year cognition here, so excuse me if I misrepresent this at all, but people generally can keep about 7, give or take, 1 things in mind at a time. So that's a good number to sort of aim for choices. It means people will be able to sort of parse everything, all of the options they have at once. As I said, you likely won't be able to cut every level down to 7, but it's a number to shoot for. I should say 7 or fewer. 7 is just the kind of upper limit there. So I'll give something like a semi-concrete example here. Say we've got our website here. We've got our second level pages, third level pages, fourth level pages. I'm going to try to illustrate here why it's effective to kind of structure things in this way. When the user is on the home page, indicated by the little house, they're seeing those 7 options. Oh, that's what I missed. Right. The page that the user in this hypothetical scenario is trying to find is highlighted in pink. That clearly didn't... Here, let me just... this one. Oh, that's a really ugly circle. Oh, well. So when they're on the homepage, they can see these seven options. Their first option should be pretty obvious to them if the site is well categorized, and then they're only presented with these five options. And then they're able to narrow that down to the page that they do need to find. So that's sort of a representation of the kind of process that we're aiming to get to. We're trying to provide a pathway for users to get through the site. Any questions for that? All right. One risk here is that a user can get lost and sort of go down the wrong... Oh, do we have a question? No. Go down the wrong rabbit hole, so to speak. And this is a risk, obviously, because not everybody's going to categorize things in the same way. In cases where there is going to be ambiguity, it's great to use links in the text of your page, in blocks, in even a sort of picture that draws the eye to sort of redirect people who might have stumbled onto the wrong section. So I think the rest of the, this is sort of the halfway point of the presentation, where the rest is going to focus a little bit more on sort of concrete, smaller scale things. I'm wondering if anybody has any questions about sort of planning the high level architecture. Yes.
Thank you. I have a question about duplication or syndication of material.
That's actually coming.
Okay, I can wait for it.
Brilliant. Let me know if you still have your question afterwards. I'll try to answer it. Anybody else? All right. So this sort of cryptically titled slide, Front Doors. Again, from the same article, he writes, to assume that at least half of your website's visitors will come through some page other than your home page. This is, honestly, it was a little bit surprising to me, because I didn't think about it that much before I read it. But I also deal with Google Analytics, and I could actually go in and check this. And actually, this holds true for a lot of McGill sites, where something like 30 to 50% of the visitors to the site will start on your front page, and the rest will come in, you know, on your about page, on your page about your, you know, international student program or something like that. So if we keep this in mind, it means that we should always remember to include sort of a context for individual pages. For example, titling a page applying because applying when it's the applying page for the undergraduate program. If you also have an applying page for your graduate program, that's also called applying. It might be difficult for people who come in on that page to sort of determine where they are, even with the context clues which are automatically provided by Drupal. Certain items in the navigation will be highlighted, but it's better to give people more context than less. This is another instance where we'll want to provide obvious paths to other parts of the site, again, in case people searched for the graduate applying page but ended up on the undergraduate applying page. Another sort of lower-level principle to keep in mind is to build your site with growth in mind. Growth not just in the amount of content, but in like the there will always be new content replacing old content as well. Eventually, because you're going to get more content on your site, it's going to get cluttered, and you're going to need to revamp again. But if you build your architecture sort of keeping in mind this, and don't make sections that will become obsolete in you know, a year's time or something like that. You can minimize the pain of this process and kind of extend the shelf life of a certain site architecture. Expanding on this, with frequently updated content, some of it will be suitable to move into Miguel's channels system. I'm sure a few of you have taken the channels WMS course. Basically, the channels system consists of news items that are suitable for releases, announcements, things that are timely, and so maybe they're true today, but they won't be true in a year or something like that. Whereas events cover anything from exhibits, workshops, deadlines, just about anything that takes place over a period of time or is defined by a period of time. Channels items obviously won't appear directly in your website architecture. This is where that distinction kind of comes into play. They would be part of your information architecture in that they're some of the content that you're presenting to users. So that's sort of the distinction that is not all that important for this presentation, but I thought I'd include it. An advantage is that old items are automatically archived in the channel system, keeping out-of-date content out of the way, but preserving it for posterity where that's relevant. Victor, I see you've turned on your microphone. So,
what does old mean, and what does archived mean?
Well, that would depend. With news, I believe it would pretty much. So, I'm mostly thinking of the outward-facing sort of thing. So, if you have a news block that has, say, 5 channels items, if you add 5 new channels items, the old ones won't be appearing in that news block anymore. That's really all I mean. Archive, I'm also referring to the, there's actually news and events archives on the channels hub at mcgill.ca/channels, which again, archive old content and allow you to kind of go in there and see, you know, what was my unit up to this time last year, sort of thing. Any other questions? All right. Hopefully I'll be able to answer your question now regarding duplication of content in the architecture. A good architecture should not present the same content in multiple places. It makes it a real pain to keep content up to date, and it's nearly always better to keep the content in one place and link to it where it's relevant. There is the exception of the blocks in Drupal, which you're able to sort of put onto multiple pages. This makes it easy to update in one place, and because they're sort of a common element, it's less likely that users will get confused and say, like, oh, why is this information on this page and also this page? They're only really suitable for shorter amounts of content, usually, though. Did I answer your question?
Yes, mostly. But the extension of the question is that if you have multiple audiences for
Yep.
your website, and it's important to distinguish between them with the tone you use,
mm-hmm.
sometimes the content that you leave in only one place
Right.
has a hard time addressing both of the audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, syndication is an option. Sometimes
Yeah.
it's an option to say, if you are this. If you are that, then that. Those kinds of things can work. They can be awkward, but I was just wondering if there was another option.
Yeah, there are always going to be tricky situations like that. Sometimes it's best to kind of enumerate what sort of differences there are. Say it's the same for this audience, except you know you have to apply in June instead of in May, or something like that, and then say, but the rest applies. It's again, this is kind of one of those cases where you have to work on it on a case-by-case basis. I say avoid duplication. Sometimes it cannot be avoided, and again, it's a trade-off, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
When it's necessary, it's necessary. Any other questions? All right. particularly when a live site is undergoing a major change in architecture, it's very important to think about the process in which you're taking these changes live. As I said before, it's better to do it all at once and sort of make it clear that the website has changed. You can also request redirects, which I'll cover in the next slide. For a little bit after the change in the architecture, especially if a lot of URLs are changing, even Google search will be a little bit confused by your site for a little while. It tends to recover fairly quickly. But it's just something to keep in mind. Redirects can be set up by IT if you put in requests for them. There are a few restrictions on that, which I think are on the forms page there. They can really only set up a limited number. It's best to then maximize the effect by picking your site's top landing pages, which are, if any of you attended my Google Analytics lecture, the pages on your site that people are coming in through the most. If you get in touch with us at googleanalytics@mcgill.ca, we can provide you with a list of these if this is important. I'll give you a second to write that down if anybody needs to. Any questions on redirects or anything like that? No? Excellent. Okay. Nope.
After a redirect, what happens to the old site?
Well, a redirect doesn't actually affect a whole site. A redirect will only affect a single address. So, for instance, if you're...
like when we were on... here. What's the... Not Drupal, but before it was... Oh, the virtual host stuff.
Yes, okay.
So we redirected from that to our new Drupal site.
Yes, so that would be a redirect at sort of the top level of your site, which I believe they can do as well, but I don't know if it'll affect every single page. In general, redirects would say, if you did one for who we are to about, it would be anybody who goes to your site / who we are would just be moved directly to your site / about. So to another technique to minimize sort of the disruption of changing your website's architecture is to preserve the aliases of pages. If you're familiar with this section in the Drupal edit, on the Drupal edit page, it's near the bottom of the page. And basically, that just determines what that page's section of the URL looks like. So wherever this is reasonable means, if there are places, for instance, that aren't good for SEO, which I'll get into, you'll probably want to change those anyway. So again, the example of / who we are is not as obvious or standard to search engines as something like / about. At the same time, if you've got your site / about and the page title is changing to about us, you probably want to keep the alias at about because that one extra word isn't going to tell search engines or users, frankly, much more about your site. And it'll just mean that anybody going to / about will get a 404 page not found error unless you get a redirect. But it's probably better in cases like that where the change isn't huge or isn't going to have a huge effect to just retain the old page aliases. Any questions about that? I think I went over that a little bit quickly. Okay. So that's actually, that is the end of sort of the about information architecture part and the start of me selling web communications as a unit that can help you with your website. So does anybody have any questions about information architecture? Yes.
I have a question about frequently asked questions.
Yes.
What's the received wisdom these days on that? What are the experts saying about the use of FAQ pages as opposed to, you know, spreading out information more equitably throughout a website?
That's a good question. I unfortunately did not research that for this for this presentation. Our practice is to use the frequently asked questions to direct people to different parts of the site where their questions are answered. The idea being that it's better to categorize things in a way that will be sensible to people than to present those things as questions to be answered, because it's a lot more likely that somebody's going to ask a question differently than they're going to categorize something differently. You know, further, FAQ sections can get very, very long if you try to present a lot of information in them. So that's why we basically try not to present too much new information in the FAQ. Yes?
Question about linking pages. How much is too much? I mean, if you start linking, I just wonder, is there anything that really is excessive?
Well, again, I'd probably... It depends on what kind of content you're looking at, I suppose.
Because a lot of things like on our site would be interconnected, mm-hmm. the units. And I just wonder, because I'm just in the process of thinking about it now, and my first thought is I have to link so many sites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think if the architecture is sort of well categorized, what you should try to do is direct people, like, say, if you're looking for student aid, loans, and bursaries, go here to this section of the site, rather than having separate ones for student aid, loans, and bursaries, because that might confuse users. And again, I'd sort of call back to the idea of having seven. I don't think it's always reasonable to only have seven links on a page, but sort of splitting things up
to other
finally.
Sites. Okay, like
links to other sites.
Environmental, you know, to security, to.
I think you can kind of apply the same principles,
mm-hmm.
Just because the user's trying to find what content they're looking for, they don't really care as much what site it lives on. So as long as it's clear, like you need to go to this site if, I'd hesitate to say you can't have too many links, but you should not. Cut down the number of links too fully. Just try to address all of your users' needs. Again, I'd call back to the focus groups and surveys as ways of collecting user feedback. So, your microphone's on again.
Did you say you'll talk about SEO later on?
I just meant I'd clarify what I meant by SEO in that context. I think SEO is probably a topic that would require a lot longer to talk about than the last 15 minutes or so of this presentation. Any other questions? All right. As I said, I'm now going to talk about what the Web Communications Unit does and how we might be able to help you. So who we are, we're part of Communication Services in the Office of Communications and External Relations. We work closely with IT on many projects, but we're sort of differently siloed from them. Where they focus on the technical side of web programming and such, we primarily focus on content. There's inevitably some overlap, but that's the distinction that we use. Our unit provides free consultation on website and information architecture, obviously. Formatting and layout of web pages, interpreting Google Analytics data, usability, accessibility, content strategy, and more. We also work in depth with units to revamp websites, both vast and much smaller. We've worked with graduate and postdoctoral studies in the past, scholarships and student aid, as well as smaller sites. If you're interested, get in touch with us, and we'll see how we can help. I'll put my supervisor's email address on here so that I don't get bombarded with emails. But he can tell you how we can help and to sort of what extent. I'll also have this up on the final slide here. We're also actually going to be holding more lunch and learn sessions over the next year or so. On August 27th, I'll be doing a session again on Google Analytics, similar to the one that I did in January, if any of you attended. And then we're expecting to do one, I believe, in November and then January or February. I don't have the dates square in my head, but we'll be doing a series. This is the first in a series of, I believe, six. So, and like with this session, we'll be putting it out in What's New and all the usual channels. I'm going to leave this slide up here because I think there are a few things on here that can be useful to people. The slides from this presentation will be posted online on the site at /WMS/examples/resources. And a recording of this presentation will be available courtesy of NCS at on the BeCool TV system. If you don't feel like writing that long URL down, it'll also be posted on the resources page. And finally, this article that I've been referring to this whole time was, frankly, a great discovery while I was researching this this topic and sort of how it's approached in the private sector. There are a lot of resources online about information architecture, and this is by far the best one that I've found. It sort of lays out, as the title suggests, eight principles, but provides a very, very concrete examples that I think really help to clarify it. It's also a very short read and only like five pages, so I'd recommend looking at that if you have some time. And again, Mark Ordinselli at McGill.ca, if you're interested in working with web communications on a site revamp or just sitting down in a meeting for a consultation. All right. Any more questions? Okay, well, if anybody wants to come up and ask me once I've shut off my microphone, please feel free. Thank you all for coming. I hope it was useful. I should note, this article was not written by the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown. Different guy. I looked into it.